Hello, everybody. Welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. We've all illustrated children's books for all the major publishers. We've all taught illustration in art schools. And together we've published something like, 50 or 70 books.
Something like that. Each week we banter a new topic in illustration that you guys send in the questions and we try to answer them as best we can. Sometimes we agree, sometimes we argue, but every time you're going to learn something brand spanking new.
That's right. Brand spanking new. You guys, this episode is dropping in January. I just want to ask you, how's 2022 looking for you guys? What's the big plans? What's the thing? Actually, I want to ask you this. What's the thing you're not going to do this year?
I can answer that right off the bat. I'm not going to move. A, that's one, number one. I'm not going to move.
Great.
Anyway. B, to go along with that sort of, I am going to try to put a focus on focusing, if that's a thing. Because what ends up happening for type A personalities like me is that I end up doing I always get the perfect amount of stuff going, like these different projects. And then I add one or two additional ones that cause the whole thing to be overloaded.
Right. It's like you've got this nice stack of cards, everything's good, and then you just dump a bunch
consistent, like, oh, I'm doing this book and I'm gonna do this Kickstarter. That feels great. Oh, you know what? Why don't I open a gallery and remodel my kitchen too? No.
I think what happens there, because I do the same thing, it's you get to this equilibrium and you're like, you might be a little uncomfortable with how much a little bit of margin you have, a little bit extra time, or you may be comfortable with it and being like, oh, life's pretty good right now. And then you have this amazing idea and you're like, oh, I could fit this in right here. And for me personally, this is what I've been dealing with lately is I do that sort of thing where I fill my time up so full that, I don't leave enough time to recover or to plan. And it's 'cause I'm always on this, it's almost this moving train. And
right.
And so then what happens is you're forced, your body forces you to recover and you start filling in all these little gaps with oh, I'm going to watch a YouTube video here and I'm going to do, and you end up wasting time.
It's so inefficient.
If you just I know at the end of the day, I've got this amount of time to unwind, to relax, I'll save it for then. Or I've got this week coming that I know I'm not going to be working. So that's kind of what I'm looking at this next year is figuring out putting more margin into my schedule,
Yeah. So you're in the same boat then. It's sort of the same thing I'm talking about. I got so bad last year that, I think of it in terms of juggling, you've got the perfect amount of balls in the air and then you're oh, I'm just going to add a couple more, even though I can't juggle this many things. Well, eventually the balls have to fall. You can't keep that up. You can for a short period of time, but you can't sustain it. And what ended up happening is I had this gallery and I would end up locking the door. I wouldn't open the doors for customers because I'd be working on other stuff. I was I cannot open the door for you.
Right. The sale that may or may not happen today is less important than me getting this, hitting this deadline.
Right. So we're at this commercial place and I'm like, no, people would even knock on the door and I'm like, no, can't come in. We're closed. And they're like, when will you be open? And I'm like, I don't know. There's no time.
What about you, Will?
I've got some significant projects that I'm working on for SBS, and they're going to take up a lot of time this year. And I have a personal project that I'm planning, kind of working on, which is a book project. And then a couple of conferences for SCBWI. mm-hmm. that are in the works. And
do we know about your book project, or is that something that you haven't shared?
No, I don't want to. I'm not talking about it yet. But it's what I'm doing right now is I'm writing it, mm-hmm. And doing little doodles and stuff, and just kind of planning. It's going to be a big project, but the problem as I see it is it's not a problem. I just don't want to put a deadline on myself for it yet. Mm-hmm. It's one of those passion projects that I want to enjoy, and I don't want it running the show. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I'm in a comfortable place where I don't have to get it done by a certain time, which is kind of nice, but I mm-hmm. want to make steady progress. So,
yeah, that's a two-edged sword, a double-sided sword, where it's like, I can take as long as I need to make this. It doesn't have to be rushed, but then
do you get it done?
It's finished.
You know what'll happen?
Yeah.
What I've always done in the past when I start one, and my book, What They Don't Teach in Art School, was done this way, is I accumulated over time, mm-hmm. and I had been talking about it for years. Mm-hmm. Once I got to a certain point where I had enough, it was like, okay, now I can schedule.
Right.
Now I can see the end in sight, kind of a thing.
Right.
And then it became very important and very scheduled at that point.
You're not just pulling it out of the ether. You've got
right.
all these, essentially, you have all the building materials. Now it's time to put them together.
Yeah.
And make a thing.
Yep.
Yeah. So,
but I can get my phone out and work on it whenever I'm somewhere, you know, mm-hmm. and thinking about it. And part of the reason why I don't like to put a deadline on it is because I am in exploration mode, and I like mm-hmm. the freedom of pondering and thinking about it a yeah. lot before I nail things down. Anyway.
Yeah. There's this, there's this guy I follow. His name's Sean Blank, BLANC. And his whole thing is he makes courses and sells them, and he's got, and it's all about like, making your life, more organized, making your schedules better, things like that. And one of the things that he and his team do is they have these 8-week cycles through the whole year. And it's 6 weeks of work, 1 week buffer, where it's like you can either catch up, or you can ideally use that week to plan for the next work cycle, but you can also use it to like, you didn't quite finish what you need to do, so you can use that week. And then there's a full week of what they call sabbatical. It's like a week off out of the studio, doing whatever, you know, family vacation, or maybe you're in studio, but you don't have work to do. And you can just like, use that time to like study or learn something or
I love that. Or
whatever. That's cool.
So that's what I'm like trying to figure out, because my kids, I have a bunch of kids at home, right? And they all have school holidays. And what's happened in the time past is these, you know, spring break will sneak up on me. And I'll be like, oh, shoot, spring break's next week. And I'm in the middle of this thing. And I guess I have to take time off because we bought tickets already or whatever. And so then I'm on vacation, and the whole time I'm stressing out about the work I'm not getting done, right?
You should show your schedule.
I'm gonna do that. I'll get to there. But then when I'm working, I'm like so stressed out about work. I'm like, I need a vacation, right? And so you get to this weird thing where you're not, for me personally, I'm not enjoying work. I'm too stressed to enjoy work. I'm too stressed to enjoy like the vacation. So for 2022, this is my method for planning it out, and that is figure out these cycles, these work cycles, and I'm gonna try to stick to this 8-week cycle, but it doesn't quite align with the kids' time off from school, so some will be shorter, some will be longer. But then in those work cycles, what you do is you set up a project that has to be that is the right size to finish within that cycle. So say I want to do a book. Figure out what I can get done in that 8-week cycle. You know, is it maybe it's half the book, or maybe it's an entire book, but it's a shorter book. Something like that. Or maybe it's a course for SVS. and really make it nice and polished. But the idea is you figure out these cycles, where to fit them in between all these vacations, and you line it up, and then you know exactly how much time you have to do the stuff you want to do, instead of just saying like, well, this year, you know, I always wanted to do like t-shirt designs, so I'll do 12 t-shirt designs, and I always wanted to do you know, Kickstarter for, you know, tarot decks, so I'm going to do a Kickstarter tarot deck, right? I like this idea of starting with, well, what, how much time do I have, and then taking that like big list of all everything I want to do and like really getting realistic about, okay, what can actually be accomplished at this time. I'm going to share my screen here and show you this calendar. So I just pulled this off of iCalendar or whatever it is that Apple has, and I cut it apart and made it one long year thing.
Smart.
Yeah. So essentially I can look at the year in like one long stream. And if you're, you know, listening to this, it's like January through December are all connected. They're not like divided up and into things. And then these red, what I've blocked out is all the days that there's no school. It's hard for me to work when the kids are home. So I'm like, at least if I know they're there, I can either plan on, you know, these particular days I'm working, but these particular days I'm off. Okay. So there's that. Now this next layer, green is work days. Blue is planning, prepping or bonus work days. And then orange is, you know, work sabbaticals. So some days, some work cycles, and I'll show you these numbers here. These are essentially the six different projects, divided up into six different like project schedules. And you could see like 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 are all kind of longer. And then 6 is a shorter one. Right. And then on top of that, I've got SVS days. So Wednesdays and Thursdays we'll record podcasts.
This is madness, Jake. This is insane. Now here's my question to you before you go any farther. Yeah. I do this too. I mean, I haven't done it as kind of clearly as I hope to do it this year, but I've made schedules before and then I immediately fall off of them and then I never look at them again. So does that happen or do you stick with
it? I mean, so what I've been doing up to this point is making plans without scheduling them. And so I'm trying this out to see like, okay, let's actually schedule this stuff. But, and I've been doing a good job for the last couple of years, like, auditing how much time it takes to do things. So I have a good handle on how long projects are going to take. Mm-hmm. And then the only way this is going to work is if, really what it comes down to is how I attack the day. Right. Mm-hmm. So if the day is set up so that I get a good solid four hour chunk in the morning to do creative work and then leave the afternoons for, you know, answering emails, taking calls, you know, doing anything that I can get interrupted easily and it doesn't throw me off, then that's going to work. But it all rests on that. And it might mean that I'm gonna have to be a bad guy more often than not and say no to stuff because it conflicts with this, you know, 4 hour time period of the day where I'm creative. Or if there's like, you know, you guys text me in the morning, like, what are we working on today? I might not answer that until the afternoon, you know?
I like it.
It'll be stuff like that. And really what Allison pointed out, she's like, you guys need to have like a code word, like this particular emergency is, what'd she say? Blood should be the code word. And blood means that this particular thing, if we don't handle it right now, we'll lose $1,000. But if it's anything under than that, then you can deal with it later. You know, so she says, figure that out to where, you know, someone can text you the code word and say, you know, blood, it needs to be happened right now. It needs to be dealt with right now so that, you know, it doesn't hurt us in the future. Or
we had one of those like 8 years ago when we first started. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
What was it?
When we didn't know that there was a download limit on Dropbox.
Oh yeah.
And so we put a class that we had just recorded in Dropbox and told everybody in the class, go ahead and download it. But promptly we got shut down by Dropbox and didn't know it. And both of us were in church.
Right.
And Ryan was with us then and he was in church too. So we're texting from church.
I remember well, I'm done with church for today. I got to go take care of this problem.
We were getting all these emails of people going, the link doesn't work.
Well, yeah. It's important. I mean, kind of the base of what you're saying is, you know, decide on what's important and let that kind of be the instigator of your day and your planning. And it's true. You got to watch out for these little stupid things. Like as our school grows and as we grow, I've noticed we have more meetings and it's just a dangerous place to be that you're just over meeting about too much stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So there's still some systems that need to be put into place, especially with what we're doing together versus our personal projects, you know, so that I'd like to have like a God calendar where it's like, what are we working on today? Isn't a text that we have to like send each other. We could just look at this calendar and know what it is. Right.
Right.
So that just eliminates some communication so that when we do communicate with each other, it's productive. Like it's like us recording a podcast or us having an important meeting. So, let's move into the meat of the podcast. You guys got to be a part of it.
Hey, can I bring up one more thing that I've been thinking about when I was by myself?
Yeah, let's hear it.
This is just a little side note. Daniel can put this in another part of the podcast if he wants to, but I've noticed that if you're holding an egg in the kitchen, you're cooking. But the second you take an egg out of the kitchen, you want to throw it. Just say it's just a weird inclination. Try it if you're at home. Try it. Just carry the egg anywhere outside the kitchen, especially if you go outside of your house. It kind of relates to my pumpkin just story.
Try holding an egg anywhere outside the kitchen and see anywhere if you're not tempted. If to
you
chuck are,
you
it.
Will definitely be tempted. I was holding an egg. I had to answer the door. I carried the egg to the door, and all I wanted to do was throw the egg.
You know, that's also probably a good personality test. Like,
yeah. What does that say about me?
What do you want to do with this egg? All right. So we're doing something a little bit different today. This is, this comes from Krish and they titled it the SVS interview. And what they did was gave each of us a question specifically tied to us. So did you guys get the email with the questions in it? You
saw? Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do is just each answer our question and go from there. And I thought these questions were very specific to our specialties and what we're, what our experience has been. So I'll go first since I'm the first one on there. It says here, hey there, Jake, Will, and Lee. After submitting many topic-based questions for you guys to answer in the past, I thought I'd shake things up and throw at you guys some questions specific to your talented and talented and experienced creators. So here it is. Jake, the creative bank account is a topic that you've discussed many times as a crucial tip for cultivating creativity. What's a way that you've added to your creative bank account in the last year that has impacted your work the most? This is a good question because it has been on the top of my mind lately. And I actually did a YouTube video back in November called How to Rewild Your Imagination. And that one was all about like mixing up your creative inputs, your experiential inputs so that you can have, a broader experience to pull from, right? There's a quote from Steve Jobs where he says, essentially, creativity is just connecting dots. And that's what essentially any sort of experience that you've had or thing that you've seen is a dot that you've collected. And the creative people are the ones who either have like very unique and different dots that they've collected, or they have normal dots just like everybody else, but they're putting them together in different ways that people haven't expected, that people aren't
you know,
used to
that.
Seeing come together, right? So taking that, I'm like, well, what can I do to have different experiences? What can I do to think things, you know, kind of look at things through a different lens, or to put things together that wouldn't normally be thought to put together? And one of the things that I realized that was killing my creativity was the algorithm. And any time that I would log on to any of these social media platforms, instantly being shown everything that I'm interested in, instead of being shown things that I might be interested in or things that I'm not interested in, and having to like sift through them. Because what happens when you're showed everything that you're interested in, because that's essentially what algorithms designed to do. It's based on your history and based on your interests. We know you're going to like this, and we know you're going to like this post by this person. Instagram was showing me, you know, I followed 1,000 people, and I just kept seeing the same posts from like 100 people, 10%, mm-hmm. you know, maybe 50 people. And so I'd be like, well, I remember an artist be like, oh, I wonder if they posted anything. I'd go and look, and sure enough, they'd posted like, you know, 5 posts since I've last seen it. Right. And I was just getting so frustrated with, missing stuff that if I followed a person, I was obviously interested in them, but because I didn't like their posts or didn't double tap on them, the algorithm thought I didn't like it. So I was just getting frustrated with that. So what I did was, I unfollowed everybody on Instagram and made a special document where I could click on all the people that I had followed. I could click on their account and kind of look at their accounts like holistically, and not seeing what they had just posted, but seeing what they have been posting. And I organized that list into categories. So like animation artists, concept artists, gaming artists, children's book illustrators, so that I could go through and be like, well, let's see what people are doing in children's book illustration. And then just click on these people and see their posts. So that's one thing that I did to kind of mix up my creative inputs through social media. The other thing that I've been doing this last year, or up to this point, to kind of shift things, was spending a little more time on websites that didn't have strong algorithmic influence. So art community websites like ArtStation, DeviantArt, Behance, Flickr, Tumblr, even if you follow a bunch of artists on Tumblr. Essentially what those places are set up in, that there is a page where it's kind of like, here's what's going on in the community, here's what people are liking, but it doesn't necessarily show you what, you know, it's not like smart enough to figure out what you like. So it still shows you stuff that you may or may not be interested in. And the whole point of that is just to be exposed to things that you didn't know that you liked, or that you haven't like grown a taste for. And so one of these sites in particular that I've been loving this last year, sort of rediscovered it. I used to use it all the time, but this last year I've gotten back into Flickr. And Flickr, there's still like people uploading stuff and posting things to Flickr. And it started out as like this photo sharing website where photographers would take photos, and it was like the place to have their portfolio. But a lot of people like share pictures of like their toy collections or pictures of their book collections. There's a bunch of people who just curate like old ephemera. I think that's how it's pronounced. Just like scraps of advertisements and, you know, weird pages in comic books, you know, and comic cover collections and things like that. And so you kind of sift through it and you wait through it and you see a lot of stuff that, yeah, you're maybe not that interested in, but then you find something that really is unique and interesting that you didn't expect, and you favored it. And then you have this archive of, like, basically you're like surrounding yourself with stuff that is out of the ordinary, stuff you wouldn't see on like an average social media post. And so that's just one facet of how I tried to mix up this creative bank account by still using the internet in a way that it helps me instead of like sucks more time and attention from me.
How did you unfollow everybody from Instagram? Did you have to do that manually?
Yeah. So here's the interesting thing. What happened was it would only let me unfollow 200 people at a time. And then Instagram would say, you're blocked from doing this action in order to protect our community. That was quote it said. And so every day I'd just go and like unfollow another 200 people. And it took me about a week to get through it.
That's interesting. So basically what you've decided to do is not let the AI program you.
Right. Yep. And so now, and it's really helpful because I did feel like Instagram was just like making me brain dead. And you know, I'm not on Facebook. I don't scroll Facebook. So I don't have a Facebook craving or habit. Mm-hmm. And the only other like social media cravings and habits I have is YouTube and Twitter. But those are primarily, I use them more on the desktop. So it's not like I'm always having access to them, right? Mm. But Instagram was in my phone, so it was always accessible. Mm. And I was just like, I'm wasting so much time. And I could delete it off my phone, but it's too easy to like put it back on. And mm-hmm. it's just a hassle. And so when you unfollow everybody, that is really hard to fix. like to go find everybody and refollow them, it's really hard. Because I haven't done it yet. I haven't, like, it's been months and I haven't done it yet. So when I open up Instagram, all I see is my last post that I posted, and I'm not like tempted to really waste time on it. Mm.
Interesting. Me and Will answer this question too?
I think we comment on it. Like, one of the interesting things for me is you're in a situation where the program is trying to take as much of your time as possible. I mean, like, that's the goal. And they've admitted that. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much all social media platforms, right? Is to try to, like if you win the war of eyes and hours, mm-hmm. you win because it's all based on marketing dollars coming in.
Yeah.
And so I tried an experiment the other day because it seemed like sometimes we would talk about something and, mm-hmm. you know, like the phone's listening. And then we would mm-hmm. see an ad for something similar mm-hmm. to what we'd been talking about. But yeah. I tried one the other day where I said to my wife, I was like, I wonder if I can make that happen. And I kept saying the word dragon because there was like no dragons in my feed. Mm-hmm. Nothing, you know. So for like a day, yeah. I'd always like say the word dragon. I don't know if it could filter out that I was trying to do that because I said it. I said what I was trying to do. Mm-hmm. But I never saw any dragons in my feed at all. But it seems like if we talk about, you know, like a can opener or something, there's a ad for a can opener.
Right.
It is bizarre.
And maybe it's more product based, so less a subject based. But if you're like, you know, I want that dragon mug. Mm. I really love dragon mugs. Did you see mm-hmm. this dragon mug? Mm-hmm. Then maybe you're going to get like dragon
or dragon on a towel or something.
I'm curious. Yeah. It's got to be some subject that never comes up. Like I'm going to test that. I'm going to talk like with my friends and my wife later, with the people that I talk to on the phone. I'm just going to start talking about getting a new bowling ball.
Yeah. Cause well, don't do what I did, which I said to Lily, I was like, I'm going to try to trick out the algorithm. I mean, I said my plan mm-hmm. and I don't know if that canceled stuff out or not, but I never saw
that's anything. A lot of AI right there. If it can decipher your intent. You know, that's rough. Will, what about your creative bank account though? Like, are you, I mean, it's basically asking about motivation and influence, right? Are you doing anything this year for that?
I don't really think about living my life in a way to add to my creative bank account, but in the class that I'm doing right now for SVS, which is creative concepting, which mm-hmm. is basically writing stories, right? Is coming up with better stories for your art and how to do that. And one of the things that I'm asking students to do is to draw. It's kind of implied, but it's to draw on your experience to write additional stories. So the idea is that there are illustrations that are more exciting and more interesting than others, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have like level 1, 2, 3, and 4. And my contention for this class, or my suggestion, is that you want to try to make a level 4 illustration whenever you can, because those are the ones that are true art. And those are the ones that move your audience emotionally and get them to react in a way that they won't forget your art. Right. And I make the contention that most illustration falls into a level. You can turn most illustration into a level 3, but some illustrations you can't turn into a 4 simply because of the nature of the assignment that you were given. And you have to illustrate in a way that you can't really add much more to make an interesting story. But anyway, that is such an important ability as an illustrator, to be able to add creativity and story. And we get that through life experiences. I have learned over time that my sense of humor, my ability to joke with other people, has just mm-hmm. increased over time. Mm-hmm. It's just gotten way better, you know? You know, mm-hmm. What is comedy? Comedy is basically giving a series of predictable things and then ripping the rug out for that last thing that's unexpected, right? And I think you get better at those things just by living and relating with people. Mm-hmm. And so I think my creative bank account is definitely increased just by the people that I interact with. And mm-hmm. I interact with a lot of people daily because now we're into pickleball. Mm-hmm. And so that's one thing. But I don't actively seek it out. Although one thing that I've always tried to do in my life is whenever presented with an opportunity to do something new, even if I'm like tired and I'm like, I don't want to do it, I don't want to go there, if it's a new place, a new opportunity, is to just say yes. It's kind of like from that movie, Yes Man, mm-hmm. taking that kind of, I think that if you live more like that, you're going to increase your ability to tell stories much better than if you are closed off and just do the same day every day. So get out of that house, Lee.
I can't. I gotta finish soon enough.
All right. You want to do yours, Lee?
Mine's simple. I want to go back, you know, I'm going to simplify this year. I'm going to do my Kickstarter for my tarot deck. Finally, I get to start on that again in January. Finish that up in, you know, early spring. And then I'm going
to
go back.
You have to read your question.
Oh. I was doing my creative bank account.
Oh, I thought you were.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to answer the unread question. Dude, I'm a pro. I'm not going to do that. No, I was just going to say, I'm going to take a class. I want to go back to being a student, at least in some capacity. But I loved your idea about the scheduling and figuring out when you're doing that, because that's exactly the kind of thing that I'll add to an already busy schedule, and then that'll be the thing that overwhelms me. So mm-hmm. I want to go back into student mode, and when I do that, I'm going to do that with intent to be a student and to explore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to take a watercolor class from a master. I mean, there's a couple of guys. Man, there's this guy on Instagram who is so good at watercolor. I look at it and I just have no idea of how to do that. So I'd love to travel and take a workshop. Anyway, we'll go on to the next to the actual next question, but I don't have it. Here we go. Here it is. As an artist whose work has reached audiences through many platforms, from gallery shows and murals to children's books, what's an experience you've had in your career that has made you realize that you can stretch your abilities beyond a singular audience? That's a good question. There's two things that I think I've really honed in on for that. And the first thing is being interested in more than one thing. I mean, that's just the base of it. And so when I was in school, I minored in industrial design. And it was that kind of thinking comes from a totally different side of your brain. You know, thinking you have to produce something that's going to be physical and it has to work versus illustration. And so just even when I was in school and I was studying, really working these two sides of my brain. And, you know, illustration is, I think, more creative and definitely less rules. But I like both sides of that. And so I was already thinking about that. In industrial design, the whole thing is making products that make things better for people, ideally, or better for the planet, or both. And so that sort of got me thinking like that. And then I was also studying industrial design, studying entertainment design and concept design. And so just being interested in multiple things, I think, is a good thing. I'm surprised how many people are so singularly focused. And sometimes I'm jealous of that because I did have too many interests, like we were talking about earlier. But some people are just so singular. Like I knew people in school who, when we were freshmen, they started out with this style of working, both the medium and how it looked. And when we left school 4 years later, they were doing the exact same thing. I just could never, ever do that. And like I said, sometimes I'm jealous of that because they just kind of knew what they're doing.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's a little bit of there's a quote that I always think of with that. And that's, if I'm doing the same thing, and I'm just going to make up the ages, but if I'm doing the same thing at 50 that I was at 20, then I wasted 30 years. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I was just kind of all over the place trying this, trying that. And so I was already kind of in that mode. But right when I graduated, I had this portfolio of children's books, kind of images from my grad show and from that last senior year, all kind of geared towards books, but I hadn't done any books yet. But I was living in Pasadena near Los Angeles, and there's two bookstores in that area that show artwork from picture books as a gallery kind of thing. And so one of them was called Storyopolis. It's an amazing bookstore with all these beautiful originals. And Every Picture Tells a Story was another one. And so I ended up submitting some work to Every Picture Tells a Story, and they ended up taking like probably 12 images. And that was the first time I just kind of had the little light bulb go off, like, hey, wait a second, I can take this thing that's supposed to be in a book and now it's on the wall. And so then that's when I started playing with what kind of images work for both. And what I realized really quickly is that it's not the same image each time. If you go too deep into a storytelling, and this is kind of weird, but if you go too deep into storytelling in a book, the image becomes so specific to that story that you can't put it on the wall because it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I have this kind of almost like, I don't know what the right word is, ethereal kind of style or something like that, where there's not a dead set meaning of what's happening. It's kind of implied. And those are the images that tend to work for in multiple places, as a card, as a print, as a book.
Right.
So do you think that more illustrators should try to do a style that's more ambiguous, less specific?
I mean, me and Jake were talking yesterday when we were doing Critique Arena, and I'll bring that story up. You know, there were some really beautiful images. The theme was star. And so people had done all these images towards star. And as we started talking about kind of this idea, that is, make the image that you want to make, but then when you're done with the image, I mean, make it exactly what you want to make, and then think about, where can this thing go? Like somebody did an image of a whale with these starfish on them, and it was just really cool. So we started thinking, like, would that be a good card? And what would you have to do to change it to be a card? Mm-hmm. Or would that be a good print? Or is it just a children's book? And so maybe it's one of those things more than the others, or maybe it works for all three. I don't think you should start to totally tailor everything for a market, but I think you make the work that you want to make, and then you find which market that is.
Right. Yeah. I think, too, though, you can, if you... try this too early, you could kind of shoot yourself in the foot where you're like, I want to make something for everyone. And there's a quote that that a friend of mine told me once. He's like, instead of trying to make something for everyone, make everything for someone. So so figure out who that someone is. And typically, a lot of times, like, you make stuff for you. I like to imagine an audience, like a stadium full of Jakes, Jake Barkers, right? And I'm making this for them, and I know exactly what they like. And what happens when you make that stuff is all the Jake Parkers out there in the world sort of gravitate to the thing that you're making, because it overlaps with their interests as well. And then you're like, well, I know this person would like this on a t-shirt, and I know this person would like this on a wall, and I know they'd like this in a book. Whereas if you're like, well, I think this kind of person would like a t-shirt, so I'll make a t-shirt for them. I don't know if that works out all too often. You really have to like sell part of your soul, I think, to to like,
well,
that's
the opposite way I would recommend too. I don't like that, where you're trying to tailor it to the audience first. You make the thing for you and then find the audience, right?
Yeah. Good one. All right, Will, you want to do yours?
Yeah. So are we reading the question?
Yeah, read the question and then give us your answer.
Here's my big chance.
Yeah.
You guys have to be quiet while I talk now.
That's impossible.
Being a veteran illustrator in the illustration world who's been working in the industry for many years, what's the most significant change you've noticed in the demand for illustration in the art world? That's a really good question.
Yeah,
I've thought about that a lot over the years, and probably the biggest change I noticed in my career, in my 30 years, somewhere around there, is the editorial market pretty much disappearing, or I would estimate 90-some% of it disappearing. There's still illustration in magazines, but and newspapers, but it's a tiny fraction. And the internet had a lot to do with that. Probably was the biggest change was magazines went out of business. The internet ate them. One thing that I think is really important for illustrators to remember and to just think of is that markets are constantly shrinking or expanding. Nothing ever stays the same, right? Mm-hmm. So things are growing or they're dying. And where there's death, there's new growth. And so the most significant change recently for me has been the growth of the ability to produce your own products and your own projects and get them out. So in the past, I mean, 20 to 30 years ago, and of course, beyond that, if you wanted to make a game, if you wanted to print a book, if you wanted to produce your own music, if you wanted to make your own whatever that included artwork, your own puzzle, anything. You pretty much couldn't do it. I mean, it was a financial roadblock that for the average person.
You had to cough up a bunch of cash.
Yeah. You had to print.
And figure out a distribution.
Yeah. You had to make all the mugs or the whatevers, you know, the prints, the whatever you wanted to sell and produce, people didn't even think about it as artists, you know. No one had that kind of money to outlay that kind of cash and that kind of risk, you know, your own t-shirt company. Most people just didn't have the money to start something like that. And now with print on demand, with those options, with companies that help you crowdfund and collect the money before you make the thing, there is just no excuse for not being able to go after your dreams today. Now, does it mean that anyone can jump in and do those sorts of things right this second, right now? No, you have to plan that and you have to build your career and you have to become really good at your craft. And sometimes becoming good at one craft isn't enough. Sometimes you need multiple crafts. You know, you need to be good at writing and illustrating to make your own book. You know, those barriers being lifted is probably the biggest demand, the biggest change I've seen in the illustration industry. As far as the number of children's books being produced every year, or the number of comic books, or the number of ads that use illustration, I'm not exactly sure where those expansions or contractions have taken place. But like, Lee, you've noticed that, at least in your personal work, that there's been an expansion in the children's books where, you know, the art director wants you to do a story that really doesn't have much of a story. So would you say that that's a kind of a more of a newer thing, or has that always been there? And
no, I think it's a total new, I think it's an entirely new market. And as well as the other side of what I'm seeing, and it's not just things that I'm being offered. I'm kind of looking at my other friends who are doing books. The other thing is autobiographical biographical or semi-biographical books have exploded in the past year.
To where you go into Barnes and Noble and you can see a whole section.
Yeah, like Amelia Earhart as a children's book and all these just different books about people. And I mean, David Hone's career really shows that. I mean, like his past, like last three books have been all just biographical. Yeah. It's just weird. I don't like
what
it.
What would the David Hone autobiography be like?
You don't like David Hone's books, or you don't like... I don't like
David Hone's books specifically. No, I'm just kidding.
You don't like the biography thing?
No, I mean, it's okay. I feel like books, oh my gosh, I'm going to get yelled at. I'm glad we don't get mail, because people would yell at me for this. But I just feel like our industry says it's creative, and then a lot of times it's not. It follows like, okay, here's the big cycle, and everybody's going to do that. And it seems like they just pick sort of a safe option. Like, everybody's doing this, I guess we'll do it too. And it sort of follow the leader a little bit. It doesn't seem as open as you would think.
But and that's another place where I would say, if the mainstream publishers aren't satisfying demand, then that opens up opportunity. Right. Mm-hmm. And so far, I haven't really seen much and if I'm not aware of this, and if anyone out there listening is aware, we'd love to know, but I haven't seen any real push for an outlet of children's books, picture books specifically, to compete with mainstream, where there's actually some money behind it in a distribution line or anything like that. But I would suspect that this goes for everyone. If you don't like the books that are being produced, and you can't get, you know, your ideas to get bought by the mainstream, but you are getting a lot of traction online, that's a good opportunity to look for ways to try to produce and distribute those things to the people that want them. There have been some anomalies along the way. We've talked about before the book Go the F to Sleep, where you know, the producers of that, they would never get that produced through, and why would a traditional publisher for children's books, they don't have a distribution arm for adult children's books. You know, that's an adult children's book. Right. So, yeah. Anyway, what do you think, Jake? Anything?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been into comic books, and watching the mainstream, like in the 90s, watching the two big comic book publishers, DC and Marvel, like lose all their top guys and have them go and make Image Comics, and seeing that thing be, you know, just this massive success, and then watching Image Comics sort of die down and then be rejuvenated with Walking Dead you know, and there's another book called Saga that really put Image, you know, on the top of the heap of publishing, and and then just see these cycles. But then also like the rise of web comics, and now we've got these comics apps like Webtoons, where you just it's formatted to be read on your phone, so it's like a panel per scroll, essentially. And then there's digital distribution through Comixology. So it's like, and then there's Kickstarter. There's tons of comics being done on Kickstarter and Indiegogo. So essentially what you're seeing and moving forward is, like Will's saying, when the bar of entry is lowered for anything, you're going to see a lot more people participating. And you're going to see a lot more crap, but you're also going to see stuff that never, that's gold that never would have been made before too. So, as you, for you as a creator, it means that, you can probably make the same amount of money with a smaller audience, but your work still has to be good. It has to find that audience. So,
yeah.
All right. I think that's it for today's episode. Thank you for joining us, everybody. 3-Point Perspective is made possible by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. And your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and myself, Jake Parker. You can find Will Terry's work online at willterry.com and also on Instagram, Will Terry Art. You can find Lee White online at leewhiteillustration.com and on Instagram at leewhiteillo. And you can find my work online at mrjakeparker.com and also on Instagram at Jake Parker, where I will not be following you. Sorry. Don't take it personal. Podcast is produced by Daniel Tu. You can find his stuff at daniel2.co, and Tu is spelled T-U. Special thanks to our SVS production manager, David Bro, for all that he does to help keep things running. Special thanks also to Austin Shirtliff over at SVS Learn for all of his help getting stuff done. Thank you to Lily Camille for our show notes. And lastly, a special thanks to Lisa Fott for all that she does at SVS Learn, keep things running. Thank you, and go draw.